You're listening to the Autism Diaries podcast. Please remember that not all our guests are qualified medical professionals. For medical or specialist advice, always ask your GP or relevant support service. Thank you for listening and enjoy the podcast. Hello and welcome to the Autism Diaries podcast with me, Danielle, writer of the Autism Diaries. I am very pleased to introduce my wonderful guest today, Miriam from the blog Faith Mummy. Miriam, thank you so much for coming along today.
It's my pleasure.
So Miriam, we want to talk today a little bit about managing different people's needs within the same household. Do you want to kind of explain your situation at home before we get into some questions?
Absolutely. I'm married for my sons. It's been a long time. It's been a long time. So I'm married to my husband, obviously. So his needs, he was diagnosed autistic, but not until he was 59. So he was diagnosed, obviously, much later in life. He has struggled with depression for almost all of his life. We discovered when my son was diagnosed that my husband also has a progressive genetic condition, which causes some difficulties, mostly sort of mild learning difficulties that people weren't recognised, obviously, as he grew up or anything. So he has neurofibromatosis. He is diagnosed autistic. He's got significant depression and he's very hard of hearing. So wow. That's my husband. So he's a lovely chap. Honestly, I better put that bit in. There's more to people, much more to people than their diagnosis. And I'm usually one to just define somebody by their diagnosis. But that's my husband. And there is just a bit of information. There's 19 years difference between my husband and I. So he's significantly older than me. So we'll put old age in. No, he'll not appreciate that. I'm only joking. And then, so then I've got twins who are 12 years old, a boy and a girl. So both of them are diagnosed autistic, but extremely different in their presentation and in who they are. So my daughter is extremely anxious. She is easily agitated, selective mute, which means that she speaks freely in the house, but doesn't speak in any other social type setting or especially at school. So that's a significant barrier for her. And then there's my son who has significant sensory needs, significant medical needs. He has a progressive genetic condition, neurofibromatosis, which has led to tumours all over his body, including a significant brain tumour. He is completely non-verbal. He has a significant sensory seeker. He's diagnosed epileptic and he has very significant learning difficulties. So a very complex household, and I'm just me. I just sort of manage all this. I don't have anything to my name that's a diagnosed thing, but I'm sort of in the midst of all this trying to juggle everybody's needs. So sensory-wise, for example, Isaac's a sensory seeker, which means that he is constantly needing that sensory input. He needs things to be tight. He needs things to be loud, boisterous, banging, clashing, loves lifts because this is physical. And then there's my daughter, who's a sensory avoider, who won't go near anything for climbing, won't, physically do things like that. And would rather silence, and would rather sit and read a book curled up in a ball. So very sort of diverse household.
Wow. Yes, very diverse. And it's interesting how you touch on their sensory needs there being opposites, because this is something I get an awful lot of questions about from people from my blog. And they often say, I have a sensory seeker and a sensory avoider. How do I manage that? I mean, would you say that that's the biggest factor that causes the range of needs, or is there something else?
That's one of the biggest factors, that and their cognitive ability, for want of a better phrase, because obviously my son requires 24-hour care because of his significant needs. So that is a significant issue because it means that I can't always be there for his sister. Sensory-wise, it's major. I mean, you've got, for example, a child that would want to bath all day because he just loves that, and a child that would avoid bathing. You've got that where it affects. Because what people don't realise is that sensory needs affect absolutely everything about a person's life. Yeah. I think people have this idea that it's maybe just what they enjoy doing, or perhaps their hobbies, or how they would spend their time. It's everything from the clothes that they wear to the food that they eat to, you know, how they would go to sleep, how you would manage getting them to sleep, their personal care needs. It is all-encompassing sensory needs. So, yes, you know, things like what I would be able to buy my son to wear as opposed to what my daughter would wear, food, constantly cooking different meals because you've got to balance the sensory needs. And what people don't realise is it's not pandering parenting. It is meeting their needs. And there is a significant difference there. I'm not making different food because I'm just giving in to them. I'm meeting the needs that are there for them that are significant needs that, you know, not just wants. There is a big difference. So for me, there is managerial things that I do. Like, I kind of see myself, I was a school teacher, so I kind of see myself as, you know, managing this within, say, like a classroom setting, but in the home setting. So separation is sometimes necessary, because if one child's going to be loud and boisterous and throwing things and making a lot of noise, and the other child is actually intimidated and terrified of that, then it's in nobody's interest to keep them together just because they happen to be twins. So we do have separate rooms for the children, and that's something that I would always ensure was in place for their safety as well as their sensory needs. Managing them as in how we do our day-to-day thing, it's significant for us because there are times in my day when it is not conducive to have the twins together, and that's fine. First thing in the morning going to school, because what one child needs to do to be calm and in a good place to go to school is a trigger to the other child. So we keep one upstairs and one downstairs. We do tag parenting, which a lot of parents will talk about when their children have significant needs. Mm. If you can't do tag parenting, then it's about getting a place, if I'm in myself, which is quite common, then it's about having a place of safety. And that place of safety is uncompromised. My son is not allowed in my daughter's room. And it's a line that can't be crossed for her safety. But so she has that undisputed place where she can have her sensory needs met, where she feels safe and secure. And equally, she would not come into her brother's room unless he particularly wanted her in. And so I have to say, right, you're the child that can be safely left alone. So here is a safe space. And I created that safe space with her in mind and with her input, so that if I need to meet the needs of one and it's triggering the other, that there is a safe space that they can go to. But that's on a daily basis. Obviously, I have the advantage that they're in different schools, so that means that they have their own space and education. So that's a lifesaver for me more than perhaps it would be for a typical family with children at school.
Yeah, because a lot of people find it quite an inconvenience having children at, you know, mainstream and a special needs school. But actually for you, it sounds like it's a godsend. So, I mean, there's two things that you've just mentioned there that I wanted to touch on. The first was the safe space for your daughter, because even as an adult with my own neurodiversity, I feel I need a safe space, and I have one. I have, you know, my office, my room, where if I close the door, that's it. Nobody comes in, where the world can just be quiet. And I think a lot of parents appreciate that their children need that safe space, but don't know what to put in it and don't know where to put it if they haven't got a room. In terms of your daughter's sensory profile, she is an avoider, you said.
Yes.
So mm-hmm. What does her safe space look like as an avoider?
So as an avoider, it would be she doesn't like overload. So she might have, say, a poster up or a picture up. But other than that, the wall would be fairly bare. Because she doesn't like to sort of looking at too many things. That would stress her out. She doesn't like hearing too much. So she would perhaps have ear defenders. If it was, for example, when they were younger and I couldn't have her in her safe space alone because she was maybe only two or three, we put a pop-up tent up. Now, that doesn't stop the noise, so we would then put ear defenders on her to allow her that situation. So her safe space would mostly be what people would consider a place of comfort. So someone like me that's perhaps not on the spectrum would consider to be curled up on the couch watching a DVD. That's the sort of thing that she would like, a quiet place that is very predictable, where she may have some toys, I don't call them sort of toys, it would be sensory tools, but for her, it would be like a little fidget cube that doesn't make a lot of noise, but that she can press and turn and twist and feel secure. For her, it's a book. She's an avid reader and she can escape into another world. The cushions, blankets, things that bring her a lot of comfort. I think for other people, I think, what would you do in a rainy day? You know, you might sit up on the couch and you watch a DVD. That's the sort of thing. So headphones to shut out the world around her, not too much visual stimulus, and just being able to zone out, to be able to sort of create a dome around her whereby she isn't bombarded with noise, isn't bombarded with sensory stimuli. And it's actually fairly minimum. She doesn't want too much because that's just too much for her. So if, for example, a teacher was creating a safe space in school for her, it would just be a small, quiet area where she can just calm down.
That sounds absolutely perfect. And I think it's important to mention at this point that, you know, so far we've talked about your twins having different needs, but different needs doesn't necessarily mean two people with different neurodiverse profiles. It could be a neurotypical child, and it could be one that's diagnosed with autism, or it could be a parent who is diagnosed and a child who is neurotypical. And it is all about finding those spaces and those ways of meeting everybody's needs. You mentioned that you used to be a teacher and that you manage your house like a classroom. And that really hit me because I thought, wow, you're using a set of professional skills to manage your family. And there are an awful lot of people out there who find themselves in similar situations who don't have those skills from that kind of environment. They might have come from a completely different type of career to become a full-time carer. What skills do you think you use the most that you used to use when you were teaching?
Organisation definitely is one. Differentiation, so where a teacher would perhaps differentiate the maths task or the language task for children that have got different abilities. For me, it's differentiating on a different scale. I differentiate the clothes. I differentiate my expectations. And I think that's a key one, is your expectations of someone else. And that, I have to say, must include the other adults in the family, because we can be very good as parents to sort of meet the needs of our children, but are we meeting the needs of our spouse, our parents, or other people? And, you know, as anybody, that's a very difficult thing to get that balance right, and to be constantly saying, well, and in lockdown, obviously, if we ever talk about that, that created a whole new set of
changes for us
and how you manage that and under such tight restrictions. So for me, it's about communicating with my husband, because I've discovered that there's no need to be disappointed, because I had expectations like, I don't know, maybe like a lot of women would have, that your husband would just know when you were down. Why would I expect someone else to be able to read me like that? Because as a woman, that's something that I would do. I would know my child's needs before they needed it. I can read my children like a book, as people would say, because you know your own child. But a husband, especially when he's on the spectrum, hasn't got that intuitiveness that perhaps I was looking for. So just simply saying, I've been up this that this week's a good example where Isaac's not been in school a lot, so he's had to be constantly supervised. So we take turns, but I can be upstairs in his room supervising him and, you know, interacting with him. And 5 hours could have passed and my husband would not think to say, oh, you've been up there 5 hours. Would you like a break now and I'll take over? Because his mind hasn't thinking like that. He's thinking of his own needs and what he's doing. That isn't selfish, and that's something I really want to get over to people. Somebody not intuitively knowing what you need or what someone else needs isn't being selfish. It isn't being a bad parent if you intuitively do not know what your child needs. Because as my husband has pointed out to me, I'm not them. How am I supposed to know if they're hungry? So that creates a whole new thing. So I will communicate, and I have taught my children that obviously for my son who's nonverbal, it's communicating in different ways. And I've had to teach my husband how to understand that communication. Because for him, if someone said, could I have a drink of juice? Well, that's obvious. He would go into the kitchen and he'd make them a drink of juice. If a child was to, what my son would do, there's maybe a straw in an empty glass and he's sucking the air. Now that to me, you're thirsty, you want a drink. My husband wouldn't see that as Isaac wanting a drink because, well, he hasn't asked for a drink. Well, he can't verbally ask. So that would be his way of asking. So I've had to interpret and I've had to sort of put in place. For example, when I was a teacher, I would pass on information about children. You know, you had children in your class that were maybe shy or anxious and you would start to see the signs. So I would be able to say to perhaps another teacher coming in, if that child starts chewing on their pencil, you maybe want to let them go to the corner for 5 minutes. That's a sign that they're getting stressed. Or if that child starts putting their head down on the desk, you want to catch them before such and such happens. Don't put this child next to this child because their personalities clash. Those were the sorts of things as a teacher that I'm constantly doing at home, and I'm constantly sort of having to sort of pass that information on, because even though it's my husband and even though he's the children's dad, his neurodiversity means that it doesn't come naturally, and it isn't selfishness and it isn't bad parenting.
And I'm really pleased you've put that in at the end there, because I really do want to stress that we're talking about your husband's neurodiversity here. And I also have the same issue in that I can completely read my son. He is a smaller mm-hmm. version of me, but there are times where I genuinely miss signals from my husband, and he has learned that he has to be really open and upfront and blatant and in my face, because I miss subtle signals. I don't mean to. It's not me not paying attention. I just genuinely don't see it. So taking into account everything you do on a daily basis, how do you meet your own needs? Because you are human. You have needs, you know, basic needs as well, like needing to shower and needing to eat. Is there a magic wand to help fix this, or is it a case of persevering to find the right routine, for example?
Partly it's finding the right routine, and it's partly me. I find that to meet my needs is my responsibility. It's not something I should lay at the foot of my husband, and it's not something I should put onto my children. So obviously something like a school day would be easy. I mean, if it's not conducive and it's not safe for me to have a shower before they go to school, then obviously when they're out, that's something that I can do. So I create the situation. I manipulate the situation in order to get my own needs met. So, for example, what would that look like in person? So I know that my son is safe when he does certain things. When he has his iPad in front of them and he's sitting in his own room, He has just been fed. I should mention that both children are completely incontinent for very different reasons. So when he is clean, when he is fed, like you would a baby, and you know that at that point, and when I say I treat my children like babies, I don't mean I baby them. I mean, in fact, of meeting their needs. So I would take, for example, if I had a newborn baby, you would feed them, you would clothe them, you would settle them, and then you may set them in a seat safe, or you would put them in a Moses basket, and that's when I would go and have a shower. As they've got older, I have taken those strategies and adapted them and continued them. So it went from them lying in Moses baskets, bearing in mind I had twins, so I had to be organised from day one, otherwise I would never have eaten and never had a shower. I breastfed them both, so I would never have been able to do anything. So there had to be a routine from the fact that there were twins, never mind the fact that they were neurodiverse. So now I create routines where they don't realise that I'm doing it to meet my needs, because in actual fact it's meeting their needs. So I put their needs first, because what other people maybe don't realise is that by meeting their needs first, I'm creating a calm environment where my needs can be met. If I look at the other way around and I say, I need to have a shower this morning and I just need to do this because I've got greasy hair and I need to have a shower. By doing that, I've already created an imbalance in the family, because then I'm focusing on getting myself ready where their needs maybe aren't met. So I'm going to step into the bathroom and one of them's going to come and open a window and throw something out, and another one's going to be crying, and another one's, because I have not met their needs prior to meeting my own. But they don't always realize that, so maybe I have to go to something or I have to do something. So I would create the situation beforehand. So similar to a teacher, if a teacher knew, going back to when I was a teacher, if a teacher knew they were going to have a stand-in coming in on the Tuesday, they would have all the lessons prepared in advance. They wouldn't expect that teacher to just come in and take over. So in order to get your needs met as a teacher, to have that time away, you have to be prepared. So somebody couldn't just phone me up and say, do you want to meet for coffee if my children were at home? That's like, no, we don't do. We don't do spontaneous in this house. Everything takes preparation. Everything takes planning. And that's just how it is. But by putting the right preparation, planning and foundation in, then I am able to get my time, my needs. And by discussing that, most of all, with my husband. Because it's one thing for me to say, like, oh, right, I'll schedule this and then I'll have my shower at 10 o'clock. But if I don't communicate that to him, he's not a mind reader. He can't assume anything. That's probably the biggest thing in my family, is don't assume anything. Don't assume the children have understood. Don't assume that everybody knows what everybody else is doing, because that's a recipe for disaster. Communication, organisation, and just everybody knowing. And treating the children that as if they understand. So obviously presenting it in a way that I know is right for them. So if I was going for a shower, I can't do anything as an adult in the house without everybody knowing. So even if I was, my tumble dryer's in my garage, and that means that for less than a minute, you're actually leaving the children unattended. I wouldn't hesitate to tell my children I was doing that for my children. Some people would say, if I do that, that's a cue for my child to misbehave. Not for us. For us, that's a cue for the child understanding that, you know, my daughter, if she calls me and I don't answer, she would burst into tears thinking I've left her and I'm never coming back and I've died. I've only gone to the garage because she didn't know. The key is letting them know. So for Isaac, I would show a photograph of me in the garage. I spend my life taking photographs of the most ridiculous things because I think one day that'll actually help him know. So I take a photograph of the garage. Mum's away to the garage. And by the time you obviously can't count, but I'll say, you watch Peppa Pig, Mummy be back. And he's not even finished Peppa Pig and I'm back, and it stops his anxiety. And I think to an extent, obviously, we can underestimate how much people understand. And for us, for me, that works for my family. I'm still on the premises. I'm just out of their sight. And if I'm out of my son's sight, I'm out of existence. And so there's an element of, he needs to know, I'm only going downstairs and I'm getting the dinner and I'll bring it back up. And so that sort of works. But as far as meeting my needs go, it's much easier. Obviously, like every other parent, when your children are at school, is amazing. You can be who you need to be. When they're out of school, summer holidays, I would be lying if I didn't say it was extremely difficult. You know, just to be able to read a book, just to be able to get a break, just to be able to sort of speak to another adult, all very difficult.
Well, on that note, you know, that's why in the holidays, so many parent carers are absolutely desperate for respite. And I know that personally, without the respite that we get, I would feel exactly the same as you. And it's interesting because I listened to all these things that you've put in place and I actually started to feel a bit dizzy because my ADHD brain was absolutely firing then when you were talking about all the different types of organization. And it's interesting because a lot of them I actually do. We have a tumble dryer in our garage and I have to tell my son when I'm going, otherwise he starts kicking in the safety gates, which lead out to the hallway, trying to find me. So those small things like that really do work, and I do make sure that he has all that he needs. He has his tablets to play on while I have a shower in the morning. But then when you get to the summer holidays and, you know, or a pandemic, and then you just don't have school full stop, you know, you're reliant on that respite to be able to meet your own needs. So I think the pandemic and the respite are two separate subjects. So let's start with respite. I am very, very lucky, and people say this to me all the time, and I don't need to be told, that we have an incredible team of enablers and also a very, very good summer club where my son thrives and they meet his needs. Now, I've been offered various options by our local authority that I have turned down because, you know, they want to send him away overnight for our night respite because he doesn't sleep. So we do get overnight respite. And immediately I argued that. And I had to bring in medical professionals. I had to bring in reports to say why that would be bad. So I've had my fights. It took about 2 years to get it right. Your twins are 12 now. Where are you with respite? Because obviously you must qualify for respite given what you're dealing with at home. What's your situation?
I'll go back a little bit if you don't mind, and I'll sort of start at the beginning of the story. Yes. Obviously the twins were, it seems the best place to start, doesn't it? So the twins were diagnosed fairly young. Isaac was just 3 and Naomi 4. So initially, the first I knew of any sort of, we use respite as the broad and its broadest terms, the first I sort of thought of anything or even contemplated the children going anywhere else was when I went to when someone came out to the house. So Isaac was diagnosed and we were told we had to have, you start all these sort of abbreviations and you enter a whole new world that you'd never heard of. And I remember being told, oh, you've got to come to this meeting and it's called an IMAP meeting. What the heck's that? You know, I didn't even know what it was. I can't even know. It was some sort of strange abbreviation, sort of all about early years intervention or something like that. Now, I can't even remember all the sort of abbreviation. But the point was we had to go to this meeting. We went to this meeting and I took my children and my son wasn't walking. He didn't walk till he was over 3. And he sat underneath the table and he sat looking at the top of the table and staring at it out the corner of his eye for the whole hour of the meeting. And my daughter wouldn't leave my arms. They were just about 3. And they'd put all sorts of toys out for these children to play with and they weren't going to interact, they weren't going to do anything. And my daughter sat hugging a sort of muslin cloth and she just sat holding it up to her face for the hour and then eventually fell asleep. and my son sat under the table gazing at the top of the table out the top of his eye. And the first thing that they said is, you know, early nursery place. In fact, they were only about 2.5. And I'm like, what? What do you mean an early nursery place? I took this as a slur of my parenting from the very beginning. It was very much like, well, clearly you can't handle your own children, so we're going to take them off and we'll do a better job of you. And I went to see a nursery. And I'll be honest, the only reason I went to see this nursery is because they had a car park that was right outside. And I looked at the doors and I thought, I'm not going to get a double buggy that was side by side through those doors. So the car park was right outside and I can carry the children in. My husband carried one and I carried the other. And the head teacher welcomed us. And, oh, I'll show you around. Showed us around, gets to the playroom. You know, let the children down to play. I didn't even let them down to play. They're 2.5. They're not going to do that. They're not going to go and play with strangers' children. Like, what do you mean, go and play with children that they don't know? You know, I'm like horrified at this thought. Besides the fact neither of them could walk. So I put them down and my daughter just sat on her bottom because she bum shuffled, so she couldn't do anything. And my son just started crawling. And her first words were is, well, stand him up to walk. I'm like, he can't.
Did she not know anything about your family?
She didn't know
prior?
I had been told they qualify for an early nursery place. You go to a nursery and get the forms and fill in. So the nursery had no idea who we were. So we turned up. So she took us straight into their office and put the children into the sensory room with a member of staff. And then she sat down and she said to me, clearly your children are disabled. And I'm like,
just in case you didn't know.
I mean, obviously, as a previous teacher, I knew they were developmentally delayed, but everybody kept saying to me, they're twins. And by this point, you know, I was aware that they were significantly behind, but there was other things that they had as strengths. And I guess I wasn't really ready to accept this and took it as my parenting. So anyway, they started nursery 2.5 hours a week and when they were 2.5. And then after that, things sort of spiraled because as soon as you had other people involved in your children, when your children have additional needs, that becomes, it's like a spiral, it's like a snowball spiraling.
Yeah.
So where everybody else's children just went to nursery and came home and that was all you saw of other, you know, that was the only, for want of a better word, professional involvement in your children. It didn't work like that for me. There was meetings, you know, 6 months later, my son was in a special needs school. We had a speech and language therapist coming out to the house because he was completely non-verbal. We had an early years worker coming out to the house. I can't remember what they call it in England, but, you know, somebody that comes out.
Probably a portage worker.
Yes, yes. Uh-huh. So it's the same idea as that. That person came out to my house once a fortnight or whatever. And we started having meetings and all the rest of it. And everything snowballed from there. So then you get the whole, you're referred to social work, which to me was just like, what? You know, there's no concerns. Obviously, they're disabled, but they're disabled because they've got a disability. And, you know, you start applying for DLA and it all happened very, very quickly. Then we moved house and that all got abandoned and everything got scrapped and they started nursery in my new, which I have to say the town was next door, but it was a different local authority. So everything that had happened before that and that local authority didn't get passed on. So we started back at the beginning again. So we had no early years worker. We had no speech and language. We had had to fight to get a special needs nursery place and so on. So when the children started school, when my son started school, my daughter was a year later because I deferred her starting. That was when the word respite was first mentioned. And a social worker said I would come out to the house. She came out to the house and started talking. I'm just going to take a break here because then what happened after that was that she said, we have to do this report and this report will get you respite. Danielle, that report took 3 years. 3 years. She came out, the social worker came out to my house every single week for nearly 3 years. It was horrific. It was all about, I mean, my husband had lost a brother when he was 21 and they were, for weeks, that was all she talked about. What's that got to do with my son getting respite?
So this was a social worker who was assigned to basically decide how many hours respite you were to be allocated.
Or what type of respite,
And had they gone beyond their role, or were they being asked to investigate your family?
They weren't investigating the family for any sort of abuse, but they had to do this. We, unfortunately, when the social worker started coming out, things had significantly changed, and I mean, in the government level. So originally, they would do a report that was just a couple of pages long. This got sent away, and you got respite. But too many people were getting respite. Too many children had disabilities. It was just a mess. So a new thing was created where it was a very, very in-depth report. I mean, it was something like 30 pages long that this social worker had to fill in. And then there'd be weeks when she was off sick, and then there'd be weeks when she had to do something else, or we had the hospital appointment for one of the children. So in total, it took 3 years. This then had to go to the council, who had to approve it. And so it was a sort of level situation. So for each aspect of it, the children were scored a 1, 2, or a 3. If you got a 3, that was the base level. 2 was that you needed a little bit more, and 3 was obviously the highest. So Isaac scored 3 in everything. He was at this point, he had very challenging behaviour. He would smear. He was having seizures. I mean, he was off the scale. And so he got a 3 in everything, and the social worker had to wait for a date, and got the date and went to the council and had to put this whole package together to prove that we needed this respite. And the council said, well, we acknowledge all these needs are there, but we don't have the funds to meet this package. We've oversubscribed and we don't have the funds left. They did acknowledge Naomi's needs, my daughter, and so she was given 3 hours a week. So social work then had a problem that they have identified this huge amount of need. And it has been recognised by the local authority that that need is there, but the local authority had no funding. But those needs can't go unmet. So we were put in a situation where social work had to agree a package of respite for Isaac. And that included overnights, and that included sort of weekend clubs that he would go to, and they've had to pay for that. And that's always been the case, because it would have to go back to the local authority and the whole package put together again. And nobody's really wanted to do that, because as time has gone on, things have changed, and therefore the whole assessment would have to be redone. And I'm like, no, we'll just sort of leave that and have it in place. So that gives you some background. So that all started. He started getting overnight respite when he was just before he was 8, and he's now 12. And everything was going okay, but children change, needs change, family dimensions change, life changes. Nobody has reassessed. Social workers have came and gone, completely different social worker now because time has passed. Nobody wanted to touch this package because they knew that they would have to do a full reassessment, and that it would have to go to the council, and then they would have to rubber stamp it. And it's just such a long process. The whole system is just not set up to really meet the actual needs of the families. Nope. So at that point in time, I'll be honest, this was a godsend and this was wonderful. We've reached a point now where this is no longer meeting my child's needs, and it's no longer meeting our needs. It's not the right thing for our family. Lockdown changed everything for us, because you've put us in a situation where respite was all cancelled, school was all cancelled, all activities, that anything that the children went to, and routine was taken up in the air, and we had to adapt, and we had to adapt very quickly. What that has done has changed, the pandemic has completely changed my family, completely changed us. We are not the same family we were this time last year, and I don't think any family will be. But for our family, that has changed the needs. It has changed the dynamics. It has changed the whole picture. And so I had to make a very difficult decision last week that I have said no to all respite. And so there will be a new assessment because, as the social worker put to me, the needs haven't changed. My children's needs are still there. The family's needs are still there. What has changed is how those needs now need to be met, because my yes. children are not essentially children. They're young people.
Yes.
Puberty has hit massively, and both my children are, for want of a better word, very much young adults now. And some things, well, significant things change when a child reaches puberty. And it's also vitally important, and this I cannot stress enough, that years ago when this was assessed, and unfortunately it still is the case, that it's based on what the parents and what the professionals feel is right. Nobody actually stops and asks the child. So, for example, I've had to sit and apologise to my 12-year-old because she was given a befriender whose remit was to socialise this child and to get her out and to be around other children. So we, between myself and the befriender, we came up with clubs that she could go to. And for 2 years, she was taken to, it's called an ASN, Additional Support Needs Drama Group. And she was taken to an autistic class where children were freely socialising, a sort of playgroup thing. She hated it for 2 years. In 2 years, nobody listened, because this was deemed what we should be doing. We should be taking a child who's autistic and we need to socialise them. But suddenly, it's sort of, as that stopped, my child had the confidence to say, well, actually, Mum, I'm not wanting that to start again. Because when it was happening every week, that was routine. And we are very guilty as adults, whether we are neurodiverse, whether we think we are professional, of assuming what we think children and young people need. And that's a very dangerous place to be, because children, we could be forcing them to be someone that they're not. And that has, to me, has been a very significant step for me of saying, actually, I need to allow my children to be who they are meant to be and not take on preconceived non-autistic view of what I think is best for them and what professionals think is best for them. We seem to be, as a society, very much about dictating to families and dictating to children and dictating to, you know, anybody that's disabled, what we think is right for them. And that is, you know, there's a whole thing about nothing for me without me, or however it's phrased. And it's about saying, I asked my son, I mean, he's non-verbal, but I said to him, do you want to go to, and I named the place of respite, and he has one word, and it's no. But you could argue, well, you know, he doesn't understand what he's saying. He understands.
He does.
And he'd had enough. He'd had enough. And it's okay for people to say, this is not right for my family, because we can be too much bullied into thinking we have to accept what's on offer because this is what everybody thinks is right. But if you don't feel it's right for your family, say no.
Do you know, I've been listening so intently to what you've been saying there, that for a moment I forgot I was hosting this podcast and I thought I was listening to another one. I was just so gripped by what you were saying. And it's so true. And I mean, I can go back to, you know, you talk about the 3 years that it took to even get anything in place. I mean, I ended up in front of two directors with reports from London Hospital saying, my child needs XYZ. I've been told there isn't the funding, but legally I knew that because they'd identified it, they had to sort it out. And I think what parents sometimes have to realise is, actually, I don't want to say it's not your problem, but it's about fighting for what your children need. And then comes the assumption from professionals that all families like ours want a break and want respite. And actually, that isn't always true. You know, we want, you know, maybe our children have interests in things, you know, maybe they want to go surfing down by where I live, or they want to play football, but they can't access that through a typical club. And we're not talking about, you know, getting a break for us as parent carers. We're talking about our children accessing something that they want to. But I do feel that they come and they're like, you need a break. And it's like, well, yes, I do. But actually, there's my child to consider first before you look at me. And I've known people be assessed in the way you've spoken about and then told that the only option for them to spend money on is respite. And they haven't been allowed to buy the tools that they need for certain activities. They haven't been allowed to spend that money doing something, you know, that's considered non-educational or anything like that. And they've been told that they have to go through an agency and send their child off with somebody who their child doesn't know, who doesn't actually understand the child, for respite, in inverted commas. And no parent is relaxing while that happens. If there's somebody who comes along, who on earth does that? I remember when kiddo was three and he was assessed, and very, very quickly we were given respite. And I was told by the person who assessed us, who's continued to work with us for years and now understands our family really, really well. And he said to me, you need respite. I know an agency that deals with children like yours. And I thought, blimey, children like mine? what kind is that? And this agency turned up and it was the manager and a lovely young girl, both really, really nice people. And her only experience of working with autistic children was, I think she had a brother who was autistic, but in mainstream. And here was my son, who was doubly incontinent. He was violent. He wasn't very verbal at all. He couldn't cope with sounds. He has a very, very complex sensory profile in that he's a seeker and an avoider. And he literally didn't go near her the entire time. And after they left, I said to my husband, there is absolutely no way over my dead body he is going out with that lady. Not because she wasn't lovely, but because she couldn't meet his need. So I then had to phone the local authority and say, your suggestion is completely inappropriate. And I was very lucky at the time that I was able to say, do you know, I know somebody who could do this. And because I was able to offer them a different option, they said, oh, okay, yeah, we'll look at it. But there seems to be a real fear in the local authority of, I don't know what the answer is, therefore this is the only answer, and I need to look like a professional who's doing something right, therefore you need to do it, or I'm going to investigate you, or I'm going to take your funding away.
Really narrow-minded. I mean, and it comes down not just in social work, but you know, we've talked about my background in teaching, but even in teaching, it's like, you know, you have mainstream and then you have special needs, and there doesn't seem to be anything in between there. And we're very inflexible. Actually, as a non-autistic, we can be, they say that autistics and neurodiverse people have inflexible thinking. Actually, the system is extremely inflexible. It's inflexible in education.
It's the most autistic system, yeah.
Yeah, because it's like you have to pigeonhole things and put them in a box. And nobody, for example, considered the fact that my son going for overnights caused his sister immense distress. And so it was like, well, it's meeting his needs and it's giving you a break, so therefore it must be wonderful. No, because if I'm up all night with his sister who's crying her eyes out because her twin brother is not there, wondering if his needs are being met and how distressed he's going to be when he finally comes home, then how am I getting a break? You know, so it was very much like they don't look at the bigger picture, and that includes schooling, that includes, I mean, I've had issues where, I know we talked about before that for me, having one child in a special needs setting and one in a mainstream has been right for the children, but I still have battles where, for example, parents' nights can be the same night and I have to go back to both schools and say, actually, I have another child in another school and this is on the same night. And sometimes both schools can be extremely inflexible, and you're thinking, you know,
this, I'm not making this up.
And then we had this, well, we don't know about this other child. I had this one situation once where my daughter has an eating disorder, and where it's very, very, very restrictive. And she had gone to this CAMHS appointment, and we had to sit at this CAMHS appointment where it was about my daughter, fair enough, but they were sitting and saying to me things like, well, you need to have a varied diet, you need to cook different things. And I had to actually stop them and say, have you actually, let's stop here. Are you aware she's a twin? Oh, no, we didn't know she was a twin. Well, really? I said, have you met her brother? No. Why would we meet her brother? We're dealing with her. Well, if you met her brother, who will eat broccoli, cauliflower, gravy, mix everything together, eat fresh, you know, homemade soup, eat fruit and vegetables till they're coming out his ears. So you can't automatically assume, based on the one child's needs, that this is an issue with the family. Because I have another son, equally, I would go to a meeting at his school and they would say, well, you know, maybe we should start limiting, you know, he would walk into the dinner hall, Danielle, and he would, you know, if somebody else had something on their tray that he fancied, he would just take that as well.
So my son used to do that.
And I remember one funny story. We went to the car for it. I mean, obviously, way before pandemics and everything took. And my son, who must have been about 5 or 6, sat and cried. And we couldn't work out what it was until it dawned on me that he thought everybody else coming up to the buffet was taking his meal. He's an entire buffet. The entire buffet. No, a huge turkey. But that's mine, because when you think about it, to him, food was put in a plate and then that was his. And we had spent all these years teaching him that what was on this plate was defined as your meal. So he thought this entire buffet must all be his. Why is everybody else eating my food? So that was quite funny, but it shows you. So he ate a variety, and they said to me, you know, we have to start limiting what he's eating because he could overeat. He wouldn't know when to stop. And I had to say, stop. He has a twin sister that's like that. So I'm trying to balance the needs of both of you, because people have a tendency not to look at the bigger picture. If you've got more than one child, they tend to look at that child as an individual, which is absolutely right and fitting in certain times. But other times you have to look at the fact that they are in a family and that there are other needs. I mean, I could sort of go into detail about times when interventions for one child have had a major detrimental effect on another. Isaac used to spend hours screaming. I'll just use one example, hours and hours and hours screaming. One thing that was a major trigger for him when he was younger, and it lasted 3 years, was doors. He couldn't abide doors being open. Doors just can't be open, because a room is defined by 4 solid walls. And that includes the door shut. I mean, I could work out straight away what his problem was. You can't live in 2 dimensions. You can't have a door open, because that's it's moving. I mean, you'll understand that. So Isaac couldn't understand. So in the summer, we stay in, we stay in a street of rather older properties, and a lot of them have storm doors on the outside. So it's like a storm door and then an inside door. So in the summer weather, and most of them in the street would have their front door open because they've got an internal door. And Isaac couldn't cope with this, and he would scream for hours. And sometimes I'd have to go over and actually shut them and just explain to the neighbours, because he would self-harm. So because this was other people's doors he was closing, CAMHS very kindly said to me, oh, you can't do that. That's other people's property. You can't ask other people to shut their doors. So you'll have to just leave your child to scream it out. You know, he has to understand that he can't demand other people to do something. This was considered as similar to what somebody might say, child development or something, you know, might have said, health visitor might have said years ago about leaving a baby to cry. You know, if you've met all their needs, just leave them to cry it out. That sort of idea. One that I was never comfortable with, but that's beside the point. But nobody actually thought about the damage that that would do to my husband's mental health, to have his child continually screaming and self-harming and aggravating. Nobody thought what that would do to my daughter and his twin sister and the harm that that would cause her, because we've just talked about her sensory needs are she can't cope with noise. Even in her safe space, if a child is screaming, throwing, biting himself, causing himself great distress, she isn't able to even go to her safe space, because that still didn't drown out what was happening, and she could have no attention of mine because I had to keep my son safe. And I had to argue that even if you did think this was right for Isaac, which it obviously wasn't, you're not thinking about the reaction that that's going to have on my heart. It's tearing my heart apart to see my child like this. You know, really, is it such a big deal for me to go over to my neighbours and actually say, look, this is causing my child so much distress, he's self-harming. He will eventually grow out of this, and I'm working with him and I'm doing everything I can. But in the meantime, would it be okay for you to open your internal door and close your storm door? And you would be incredible how people can be very obliging.
Yeah.
Because he was out in the street screaming on the ground, throwing himself down. And when your neighbours think, oh, that's over my door, I mean, you would have to be very discompassionate.
Well, exactly. If people do understand these things. And I think also what you're describing there comes down to the whole, is it a tantrum or is it a meltdown? And you have to manage the two completely differently. And he couldn't cope. This wasn't him being spoiled. This wasn't him trying to get his own way. It was something that was genuinely causing him distress. And, you know, to turn around and say something like that without taking into consideration the effect of the rest of your family's mental health is quite shocking, to be honest. Miriam, I could talk to you for hours. I could listen to you speak for hours, but sadly, I'm going to have to bring it to a close. Is there anything else that you would like to add before we finish?
That's a big question. I could.
Well, it is, isn't it? and you've got 3 minutes.
I would say, don't be afraid to accept your family for who they are, and to be able to stand up and say, this is okay, because we do have a tendency still in society and in professionals and in schools to say, this is wrong. You know, so fiddling with toys when the teacher's talking to you is wrong. Who says it's wrong? They're neurodiverse. Are you neurodiverse? Is this a problem for you? Is it really such a big deal, is my question. It would be to parents, it would be to the teachers, it would be to professionals. Obviously, you know, a child screaming in the street that I've just talked about is a big deal, but there are lots of things that my children do that in the grand scale of things, and my husband does, is it really such a big deal?
Don't my husband's sweat away the small today. Stuff. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And be willing to accept things, because there are things you're never going to change, and that is okay. And being able to accept, my daughter is 12 and she's never worn a pair of tights in her life. She doesn't like them and doesn't cope with them. Do you know what? If she's an adult and she never wears a pair of tights in her life, does it actually matter in the grand scale of things? No, it doesn't. I don't particularly like tights myself. So, you know, it's just sort of saying, change what maybe absolutely has to be, things that are causing the child distress, and maybe put another, you know, you can't have your child going around attacking other people. We all accept that. But if your child is sitting flapping, you don't need to change that. That's not a big deal. And you find a way around it. If it's distressing someone else, they could leave. Actually, there's a bit of a radical idea.
I know, shocking, isn't it?
Shocking, you know. You know, so it's quite a sort of, I don't know, maybe it's an empowering idea to accept your child and yourself for who you are and allow them to be who they are, and don't have anybody else bully you or anyone else into changing your child. I say unnecessarily, because I have to quantify that, because clearly there are aspects of self-harming, there are aspects of things that you want to work with your child and you want to make things better. But if they want to watch the same 10 seconds of Peppa Pig for 12 years and it's bringing them great delight, if it's annoying you, you walk out. Sorry, you know.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Because it's not, it's fine. And you know what? The more we, as my daughter would say, why can't we just be kind to everybody?
Miriam, it has been a huge pleasure and I am sure that we will have you back on. Thank you so, so much for coming on and telling your story. And yes, hopefully we will have you back on the show soon. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. Remember, you can check out the Autism Diaries Facebook page and Instagram page. And Miriam's blog, Faith Mummy, is also up on Facebook. And I highly recommend that you check it out. Thank you so much. And we will see you next time.